Hey everyone, welcome back to The Forum, where science comes to socialize, the official podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy. If you can't recognize our voices at this point, I'm Daniela, and I'm joined today by two of my favorite people.
Favorite people? Wow, Aubrey, looks like we did it.
Yeah, we did it. We can all go home now. We're done.
Yeah, because, you know, the real reason we were here for this podcast was just to get on Dee's favorite list.
Well, I mean, I would have guessed that you've been on it for a while, Cleo. Remember how in a recent episode, Daniela basically volunteered to be your key surveillance person in your life? You know, after she stressed the need to know every single detail of your life?
Well, when you put it that way, you make me sound a bit creepy.
Well,
all right. You know we're just messing, Daniela. Or are we?
Yeah. Anyway, without wanting to prove your point, I do know that you're going to love this episode, Cleo.
And how do you know that?
Well, everyone does know that you and I share a love of food-related episodes, and this is another one from ISGP's Food Safety, Security, and Defense series.
Okay, you do have a point. I love our food chats so much.
Okay, great. So today's episode is based on a debate that took place at the Institute on Science for Global Policy's conference at Cornell University just over 3 years ago in October 2014.
This conference was called Food Safety, Security, and Defense, Focus on Food and the Environment. And the policy position paper we're focusing on today was written by Dr. John Ingram, the Food Systems Program Leader at the Environmental Change Institute at the University of Oxford. The paper was titled Food Systems and Environmental Change, Navigating the Two-Way Street.
If you're as excited about these topics as Dee and I are over here, be sure to communicate with us on our social media channels. You'll find us on Twitter at ISGP Forum and on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGP Forum.
So should we start with our typical summary on the current state of global food security that I feel is almost our mission statement at this point?
We do discuss that pretty often, don't we? I suppose there are worse mission statements you can have, but yeah, let's go for it. Although do excuse us if the next 30 seconds sounds super familiar to you, we do need to make sure that all of our listeners, seasoned and novice, are on the same page.
I'll take it from here. So while advances in food production have progressed, nearly 1 billion people are still hungry, and about 2 billion more lack sufficient nutrients in their diets.
Inadequate nutrition for billions of people can be attributed to poor access to foods comprising a balanced diet, which for most is caused often by poverty. Economic position is inextricably linked to food security.
And while most people perceive food insecurity to mean starvation and hunger, the definition actually extends in the other direction as well. One of the fastest growing and critical threats to food security is actually obesity, as more than 2 billion people in this crazy world are either overweight or obese. Recent trends in income and food marketing are influencing diet and lifestyle changes, and these changes are leading to staggering stats when it comes to obesity.
Meanwhile, the problems continue when it comes to food impacts on the physical environment. Current methods of producing, processing, packaging, transporting, retailing, and consuming food are contributing to natural resource degradation. And, I mean, food security really does depend on these resources.
Exactly, because food security and environmental issues are not only about food production, but relate to how the food system as a whole operates. In other words, when thinking about environmental issues, we need to consider all of the activities in the supply chain for food production.
Right, beginning with food production, followed by food processing.
Then, of course, packaging and distributing, and finally, retailing and consuming.
So, looking at the entire process, from farm to plate, per se.
Right. Food system impacts related to both food security and the environment are currently, well, suboptimal. That's really the nicest way I can put it. Agriculture and fisheries, taken together, account for more than 20% of greenhouse gas emissions. So there's a starting point for you if you want to talk about food system impacts on the environment.
Not to mention that about 25% of global land area suffers from degradation, largely due to inefficient food production.
Then there's the fact that about 75% of extracted freshwater is earmarked for irrigation.
And finally, about 70% of fish stocks are either overexploited or depleted.
And this covers only the production of food, which only makes up a small part of that food system supply chain.
And the other food system components have their own environmental footprints.
For example, about 40% of US and 60% of UK greenhouse gas emissions originating in the food sector are the result of post-farm activities.
And on top of that, food processing accounts for 5 to 10% of industrial water use, and food processing effluent often pollutes water courses.
A full food system approach to food security recognizes that each of these system components plays a role in both human and environmental security.
Right. So beyond the obvious environmental impacts, this approach also considers food and nutrition security, including access to and utilization of food, as well as other socioeconomic outcomes such as employment and even wealth.
So as interactions between food security and the environment have begun taking center stage, Dr. Ingram points out that there's a growing concern over a growing population. More people means increases in food demands if we want to ensure food security for everyone.
Which we certainly do. I mean, that's what this whole conversation is about.
Thank God for that. What I'm not thankful for, though, is that a growing population is not the sole issue in the link between food security and the environment. We also have the threats of climate change to consider, as they will increasingly be undermining food production at the same time.
And this is going to require giving some serious thought to how we're going to manage our food-related uses of land and marine resources, as their increasing demand will certainly have effects on biodiversity and ecosystem functioning.
So, if it's not obvious already, Dr. Ingram argues that there's an urgent need to improve food systems to enhance food security and health outcomes, improve efficiency, and reduce environmental impacts.
Simultaneously?
Yep, simultaneously.
Sounds like a tall order, and I'm not talking about my typical Starbucks order here.
Oh, you and your oh-so-not-corny puns. But anyway, so then the obvious question to ask is, what strategies exist to help achieve these goals? As awful as your Starbucks joke was, Daniela, you're completely right. Tackling nutrition, food production efficiency, and sustainability all at the same time sounds pretty near impossible.
Well, Dr. Ingram argues that a solution can be found, or at least worked towards, by adopting a food systems approach that promotes innovative research and policy agendas. Such an approach would raise awareness of the potential unintended consequences of policy interventions aimed at enhancing the system's outcomes.
Right. It would allow for a systematic analysis of trade-offs between potential winning and losing strategies.
Okay, like what?
Well, okay. Let's say, for example, policymakers decided to prioritize environmental concerns and impose a tax on all fruits and vegetables that travel further than a certain amount of miles. We'll say 100 for now.
All right, sounds like a good idea. Incentivizing people to shop local, which would decrease demand for foods that travel far distances and therefore contribute to greenhouse gas emission levels through, of course, transportation.
Right, but wait, this means that the price of fruits and vegetables could increase. This may not be the case everywhere, but I mean, at least where I grew up, local foods were always more expensive because they weren't mass produced. Economies of scale.
Exactly the point I'm trying to make. Thanks, Cleo. By introducing this policy, we're addressing environmental concerns, which is awesome. But at the same time, we're increasing risks of food insecurity for some families that used to rely on the less expensive imported fruits and veggies and now can't afford either local or imported ones.
Okay, so this is what you mean by a food systems approach allowing us to see the trade-offs between strategies.
That's exactly it. It sort of in a way helps navigate the food security slash environment two-way street.
And in attempting to navigate this street, there are a host of research opportunities that stem from this approach and span all food system activities.
And the ultimate goal of this research is to develop resource-efficient food systems. This ultimate goal can be achieved through various intermediate goals from both the production and consumption sides, including improving input use efficiency from the production side and reducing food waste from the consumption side.
Key research areas here span three general domains, if you will. They are technical, institutional, and behavioral. And to ensure research outputs are appropriate and viable, the full set of food system stakeholders, including policy, business, civil society, and researchers, all needs to be engaged.
So what do these domains of research actually entail?
Well, let's start with technical research areas. First, we want to minimize the yield gap for many cropping systems by teasing out and then ameliorating yield-reducing factors, as well as improving nutrient and water use efficiency. Then, we'd seek to develop cultivars, which are plants produced by selective breeding, with enhanced nutrient profiles to help address hidden hunger.
Another area of research here involves maintaining food safety and taste while reducing salt, fat, and sugar content. And along the food safety lines, of course we've got to mention the need for continued research on rapidly and accurately preventing and detecting and controlling foodborne pathogens.
Now, those are the technical research areas, but as we said, there are also institutional opportunities related to this research, and those begin with reduction of barriers to innovation, a classic problem in many areas of science and society.
This also includes understanding governance hierarchies among the wide array of state and non-state food system actors, reversing policies that promote the use of food products as biofuels, enhancing intra-regional trade, and finally, bolstering strategic food reserves.
And the third research domain, which happens to be my personal favorite, consists of behavioral research, which Dr. Ingram outlines as having five key opportunity areas. Jeez, there's definitely a theme of lists today.
Okay, so on the behavioral science side of things, the first opportunity we have is understanding and overcoming resistance to innovative technologies such as new cultivars, genomics, and genetic modification, which we, of course, have spoken about regularly here on this podcast.
Additionally, studying behavior through a food systems approach entails assessing strategies for the reduction of food waste by minimizing the quote-unquote buy and bin phenomenon. This is just a fancy way of describing what happens when consumers literally buy too much food and then throw it out because it expires before they ever consume it.
Which is directly linked to the third research opportunity, looking at increasing consumer acceptance of novel foods. For example, those derived from algae and insects.
Eating insects? I'm not sure if I could ever see myself doing that personally.
Actually, insects are really good for you and a good meat substitute when it comes to getting protein into your diet.
Guess it's just a good thing I'm not a vegetarian then.
But they really don't taste bad either. It all depends on your skills in the kitchen, of course.
Why am I not surprised that you eat insects, Daniela?
Actually, their popularity is on the rise, and it's even becoming a sort of hipster trend. I know there are several restaurants here in London that serve insects.
Okay, again, good thing I don't consider myself hipster, and also, you think that kind of talk is going to make me want to come visit you?
I appreciate the sarcasm.
Well, in the same vein, the fourth research opportunity in the behavioral domain involves increasing awareness among consumers of social, economic, and environmental sustainability issues.
And finally, the last research area involves reducing so-called prophylactic use of herbicides and pesticides in arable systems, and antibiotics in intensive animal systems, both of which lead to a buildup of resistance.
And an overarching challenge across all three domains lies in developing frameworks and tools to assess the synergies and trade-offs of implementation when it comes to modifying parts of the food system.
Right. Policymakers need to be able to gauge the impacts of any technical, institutional, or behavioral change on both the winners and the losers of that change.
But debaters agreed that policymakers should not only engage retrospectively by analyzing such impacts, but they also need to proactively create a policy environment that encourages food system changes. What kind of changes, you may ask? Well, the ones that are shown to enhance food security while reducing environmental impacts, of course.
It was also argued that policymakers need to challenge political lobbying that blocks change. For example, industry lobbying against the implementation of biofuel quotas and trade tariffs proposed to mitigate exploitation of natural resources were both mentioned during the debate.
The private sector does play an influential role, and so they need to be included in the conversation to truly achieve a food systems approach. As food is largely being produced, processed, distributed, and sold by private actors, ranging from smallholder farms to large food and retail companies, engaging private actors is crucial in the transition towards more sustainable food systems.
And how exactly do you, or I mean the debaters, I guess, suggest that we do this?
Well, it was suggested that private sector actors need to increase their efforts in assessing the resource use and efficiency of their own activities.
But beyond private sector engagement, debaters also emphasized that civil society needs to participate in the sustainability debate by having a more serious discussion about dietary change. This could be facilitated through NGOs and social media.
I think that sort of conversation might be on the rise on social media. Scrolling through the forum's Twitter timeline, I see a lot of info about nutritional and dietary information, and tons of posts on sustainability and reducing food waste.
But I think the debaters were more focused on diet here, and this sort of advocacy for dietary change will need encouragement and cooperation from both industry and policy.
Right. From the industry side, advertising, labeling, and peer pressure are key steps in encouraging dietary changes.
And from a policy side, regulation, say in the form of a sugar tax, could also be an important driver of societal change.
Right. So in order to aid policy and industry in adopting this approach, the debaters emphasize the need for whole system models that simultaneously assess both the nutrition and environmental outcomes of given policy interventions on the food system.
Okay, so we get the point. Researchers, policymakers, and industry stakeholders all need to work together in transforming today's paradigm when it comes to sustainability and dietary patterns. But Dr. Ingram emphasized that when collaborating on such work, there are a few things that all stakeholders need to keep in mind.
First, stakeholders must recall the importance of nutrition, not just calories, in reducing the incidence of poor mental and physical development, especially in the population under the age of 5.
Not to interrupt, but actually, this topic is being recognized more and more for its importance. Micronutrient deficiencies at a young age are finally being talked about as a defining factor in later adult development. And this is being considered from both a human health perspective and an economic and societal health perspective.
Care to elaborate?
Well, a few months ago, I got the chance to see the president of the World Bank give a talk here at the London School of Economics. He urged that addressing micronutrient intake is key for a country to develop properly, because without a healthy population, a country doesn't have a healthy workforce, and its economy suffers.
It's definitely cool to see a topic we talk about so often on the show actually get its due diligence in societal conversations.
Right? Yeah. Anyway, my bad for interrupting. I know I do it a lot, but I've just been getting super excited about this topic lately. Recall my excitement during our episode, Romaine Calm and Curion, which I'm still so proud of the title, by the way. You can also hear us talk about vitamin A deficiencies and how biotech could provide solutions.
And just for throwing it back to one of our past episodes, I will forgive you for interrupting this one time. Anyway, so where were we?
This interaction literally describes the two of you in a nutshell. But anyway, I think we were outlining the points that Dr. Ingram emphasizes about collaborative work.
Right. Okay. So, Dr. Ingram continued by pointing out that those engaged need to recognize the growing crisis of overconsumption, which has substantial negative consequences economically, socially, health-wise, and, of course, environmentally.
Where are we on the list now? Fourth?
Sure. That sounds right.
Okay. Fourth, stakeholders need to address how urbanization is both lengthening food chains and reducing the ratio of producers to consumers.
Or, in other words, urbanization and globalization are allowing fewer producers to feed more mouths by distributing their food across longer distances, another topic we've addressed in previous episodes.
And finally, the fifth and last point Dr. Ingram offers for consideration is the value of urban horticulture, rather than agriculture, in enhancing nutrition, livelihoods, and waste recycling, as well as reducing food losses of highly perishable produce and transport.
Well, as I think we've rattled off just about as many lists as is humanly possible today, I feel like we're at a perfect stopping point for the day. But before we do so, Cleo, do you want to quickly remind us of the difference between horticulture and agriculture, as I know this is right up your alley?
Sure thing. I almost feel patronized as the former farm girl rep on the show, but in any case, horticulture is actually a branch of agriculture itself. It's basically the science of growing plants, including fruits, vegetables, flowers, and any other cultivars. It also includes plant conservation, landscape restoration, soil management, and arboriculture.
So the main difference between horticulture and agriculture is that horticulture doesn't include large-scale crop production or animal husbandry, right?
Exactly.
Horticulturalists apply their knowledge, skills, and technologies to growing plants for human food and non-food uses, and for personal or social needs. Their work involves plant propagation and cultivation with the aim of improving plant growth, yields, quality, nutritional value, and resistance to insects, diseases, and environmental stresses. And now I take it back. Now we have done all of the lists that I can think are possible today.
Okay, well, this list is directly linked to the issues we've spoken of in this episode.
Okay, so I think it's about time we wrap it up and recap what those were then.
Yeah, so today we attacked the tricky issues surrounding the link between the fact that nearly 1 billion people are still food insecure and the impacts of the food system on the environment.
And when we say food insecure, we don't just mean hungry.
Right. As we mentioned earlier, one of the fastest growing and critical threats to food security is actually obesity.
And at the same time, problems continue when it comes to food impacts on the physical environment. Current methods of producing, processing, packaging, transporting, retailing, and consuming food are contributing to natural resource degradation.
And to approach this problem, Dr. Ingram argues that when thinking about environmental issues, we need to consider all of the activities in the food supply chain.
In other words, if you should take anything from this episode, it's the need to consider the entire food production system when making lifestyle choices, as Dee calls it, thinking from farm to plate.
So after this episode, hopefully we've got you thinking along the same lines. We would love for you to join the conversation on social media and tell us what you think.
Did we miss any strategies for sustainably linking food in the environment?
If so, help us out and share them with us via our Twitter account at ISGPForum or on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPForum.
From the Institute on Science for Global Policy, thanks for tuning in today and, of course, for socializing with science.
We'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.